Chapter 24, Continued. Harry went to rejoin Ron and Hermione. "What did he want?" Ron said, the moment Harry had sat down. "He offered to help me with the golden egg," said Harry. "He shouldn't be doing that," said Hermione, looking very shocked. "He's one of the judges, and anyway, you've already worked it out, haven't you?"
Nearly," said Harry.
"Well, I don't think Dumbledore would like it if he knew Bagman was trying to persuade you to cheat," said Hermione, still looking deeply disapproving. "I hope he's trying to help Cedric as much."
"He's not, I asked," said Harry. "Who cares if Diggory's getting help?" said Ron. Harry privately agreed.
"Those goblins didn't look very friendly," said Hermione, sipping her butterbeer. "What were they doing here?"
"Looking for Crouch, according to Bagman," said Harry. "He's still ill. Hasn't been into work."
"Maybe Percy's poisoning him," said Ron. "Probably thinks if Crouch snuffs it, he'll be made head of the Department of International Magical Cooperation."
Hermione gave Ron a "don't joke about things like that" look and said,
"Funny, goblins looking for Mr. Crouch. They'd normally deal with the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures." "Crouch can speak loads of different languages, though," said Harry. "Maybe they need an interpreter."
"Worrying about poor Ickle Goblins now, are you?" Ron asked Hermione. "Thinking of starting up SPUG or something? Society for the Protection of Ugly Goblins?"
"Ha, ha, ha," said Hermione sarcastically. "Goblins don't need protection. Haven't you been listening to what Professor Binns has been telling us about goblin rebellions?"
"No," said Harry and Ron together.
"Well, they're quite capable of dealing with wizards," said Hermione, sipping more of her butterbeer. "They're very clever. They're not like house elves who never stick up for themselves."
"Uh-oh," said Ron, staring at the door. Rita Skeeter had just entered. She was wearing banana yellow robes today, her long nails were painted shocking pink, and she was accompanied by her paunchy photographer. She bought drinks, and she and the photographer made their way through the crowds to a table nearby, Harry, Ron and Hermione glaring at her as she approached. She was talking fast and looking very satisfied about something.
"Didn't seem very keen to talk to us, did he, Bozo? Now, why would that be, do you think? And what's he doing with a pack of goblins in tow, anyway? Showing them the sights. What nonsense. He always was a bad liar. Reckon something's up. Think we should do a bit of digging? Disgraced ex-head of magical sports Ludo Bagman. Snappy start to a sentence, Bozo. We just need to find a story to fit it."
"Trying to ruin someone else's life?" said Harry loudly.
A few people looked around. Rita Skeeter's eyes widened behind her jewelled spectacles as she saw who had spoken.
"Harry," she said, beaming. "How lovely. Why don't you come and join..."
"I wouldn't come near you with a 10-foot broomstick," said Harry furiously. "What did you do that to Hagrid for, eh?"
Rita Skeeter raised her heavily pencilled eyebrows.
"Our readers have the right to know the truth, Harry. I'm merely doing my..."
"Who cares if he's half-giant?" Harry shouted. "There's nothing wrong with him."
The whole pub had gone very quiet. Madame Rosmerta was staring over from behind the bar, apparently oblivious of the fact that the flagon she was filling with mead was overflowing. Rita Skeeter's smile flickered very slightly, but she hitched it back almost at once. She snapped open her crocodile-skin handbag, pulled out her Quick Quotes quill, and said,
"How about giving me an interview about the Hagrid you know, Harry, the man behind the muscles, your unlikely friendship and the reasons behind it? Would you call him a father substitute?"
Hermione stood up very abruptly, her butter beer clutched in her hand as though it was a grenade.
"You horrible woman!" she said through gritted teeth. "You don't care, do you? Anything for a story, and any one will do, won't they? Even Ludo Bagman!"
"Sit down, you silly little girl, and don't talk about things you don't understand," said Rita Skeeter coldly, her eyes hardening as they fell on Hermione.
"I know things about Ludo Bagman that would make your hair curl. Not that it needs it," she added, eyeing Hermione's bushy hair.
"Let's go," said Hermione. "Come on, Harry. Ron."
They left. Many people were staring at them as they went. Harry glanced back as they reached the door. Rita Skeeter's Quick Quotes quill was out. It was zooming backwards and forwards over a piece of parchment on the table.
"'She'll be after you next, Hermione,' said Ron, in a low and worried voice as they walked quickly back up the street.
"'Let her try,' said Hermione shrilly. She was shaking with rage. "'I'll show her. Silly little girl, am I? Ooh, I'll get her back for this. First Harry, then Hagrid.'
"'You don't want to go upsetting Rita Skeeter,' said Ron nervously. "'I'm serious, Hermione. She'll dig something up on you.'
"'My parents don't read the Daily Prophet. She can't scare me into hiding,' said Hermione,
now striding along so fast that it was all Harry and Ron could do to keep up with her. The last time Harry had seen Hermione in a rage like this, she had hit Draco Malfoy around the face.
"'And Hagrid isn't going to hide any more. He should never have let that excuse for a human being upset him. Come on!'
Breaking into a run, she led them all the way back up the road, through the gates flanked by winged boars, and up through the grounds to Hagrid's cabin. The curtains were still drawn, and they could hear Fang barking as they approached.
"'Hagrid!' Hermione shouted, pounding on his front door. "'Hagrid, that's enough! We know you're in there. Nobody cares if your mum was a giantess, Hagrid. You can't let that foul Skeeter woman do this to you. Hagrid, get out here. You're just being—'
The door opened. Hermione said, "'About to—' and then stopped, very suddenly, because she had found herself face to face not with Hagrid, but with Albus Dumbledore.
"'Good afternoon,' he said, pleasantly, smiling down at them.
"'We wanted to see Hagrid,' said Hermione in a rather small voice.
"'Yes, I surmised as much,' said Dumbledore, his eyes twinkling. "'Why don't you come in?'
"'Oh, okay,' said Hermione.
She, Ron and Harry went into the cabin. Fang launched himself upon Harry the moment he entered, barking madly and trying to lick his ears. Harry fended Fang off and looked around. Hagrid was sitting at his table, where there were two large mugs of tea. He looked a real mess. His face was blotchy, his eyes swollen, and he had gone to the other extreme where his hair was concerned. Far from trying to make it behave, it now looked like a wig of tangled wire.
"'Hi, Hagrid,' said Harry.
Hagrid looked up.
"'Hello,'
he said in a very hoarse voice.
"'More tea, I think,'
said Dumbledore, closing the door behind Harry, Ron and Hermione, drawing out his wand and twiddling it. A revolving tea tray appeared in mid-air, along with a plate of cakes. Dumbledore magicked the tray onto the table, and everybody sat down. There was a slight pause, and then Dumbledore said,
"'Did you by any chance hear what Miss Granger was shouting, Hagrid?'
Hermione went slightly pink, but Dumbledore smiled at her and continued.
"'Hermione, Harry and Ron still seem to want to know you, judging by the way they were attempting to break down the door.'
"'Of course we still want to know you,' Harry said, staring at Hagrid. "'You don't think anything that Skeeter cow—' "'Sorry, Professor,' he added quickly, looking at Dumbledore. "'I have gone temporarily deaf and haven't any idea what you said, Harry,' said Dumbledore, twiddling his thumbs and staring at the ceiling.
"'Right,' said Harry sheepishly.
"'I just meant, Hagrid, how could you think we'd care what that woman wrote about you?'
"'To—' Fat tears leaked out of Hagrid's beetle-black eyes and fell slowly into his tangled beard.
"'Living proof of what I've been telling you, Hagrid,' said Dumbledore, still looking carefully up at the ceiling. "'I have shown you the letters from the countless parents who remember you from their own days here, telling me in no uncertain terms that if I sacked you, they would have something to say about it.'
"'Not all of them,' said Hagrid, hoarsely. "'Not all of them want me to stay.' "'Really, Hagrid, if you are holding out for universal popularity, I'm afraid you will be in this cabin for a very long time,' said Dumbledore, now peering sternly over his half-moon spectacles. "'Not a week has passed since I became headmaster of this school when I haven't had at least one owl complaining about the way I run it. But what should I do? Barricade myself in my study and refuse to talk to anybody?
You're not half giant, said Hagrid, croakily.
Hagrid, look what I've got for relatives, Harry said furiously. Look at the Dursleys.
"An excellent point," said Professor Dumbledore. "My own brother, Aberforth, was prosecuted for practising inappropriate charms on a goat. It was all over the papers. But did Aberforth hide? No, he did not. He held his head high and went about his business as usual. Of course, I'm not entirely sure he can read, so that may not have been bravery."
"Come back and teach, Hagrid," said Hermione quietly. "Please come back. We really miss you."
Hagrid gulped. More tears leaked out down his cheeks and into his tangled beard. Dumbledore stood up.
"I refuse to accept your resignation, Hagrid, and I expect you back at work on Monday," he said. "You will join me for breakfast at 8:30 in the Great Hall. No excuses. Good afternoon to you all."
Dumbledore left the cabin, pausing only to scratch Fang's ears. When the door had shut behind him, Hagrid began to sob into his dustbin-lid-sized hands. Hermione kept patting his arm, and at last Hagrid looked up, his eyes very red indeed, and said,
"Great man, Dumbledore, great man."
"Yeah, he is," said Ron. "Can I have one of these cakes, Hagrid?"
"Help yourself," said Hagrid, wiping his eyes on the back of his hand. "He's right, of course. You're all right. I've been stupid. My old dad would have been ashamed of the way I've been behaving."
More tears leaked out, but he wiped them away more forcefully and said,
"Never shown you a picture of my old dad, have I? Here."
Hagrid got up, went over to his dresser, opened a drawer, and pulled out a picture of a short wizard with Hagrid's crinkled black eyes, beaming as he sat on top of Hagrid's shoulder. Hagrid was a good 7 or 8 feet tall, judging by the apple tree beside him, but his face was beardless, young, round and smooth. He looked hardly older than 11.
"That was taken just after I got into Hogwarts," said Hagrid, croakily. "Dad was dead chuffed. Thought I might not be a wizard, see, because me mum... Well, anyway, of course, I never was great shakes at magic, really, but at least he never saw me expelled. Died, see, in my second year. Dumbledore was the one who stuck up for me after Dad went. Got me the gamekeeper job. Trusts people, he does. Gives them second chances. That's what sets him apart from other heads, see? He'll accept anyone at Hogwarts, so long as they've got the talent. Knows people can turn out okay, even if their families weren't, well, all that respectable. But some don't understand that. There's some who'd always hold it against you. There's some who'd even pretend they just had big bones rather than stand up and say, 'I am what I am, and I'm not ashamed.' 'Never be ashamed,' my old dad used to say. There's some who'll hold it against you, but they're not worth bothering with. And he was right. I've been an idiot. I'm not bothering with her no more. I promise you that. Big bones. I'll give her big bones."
Harry, Ron and Hermione looked at each other nervously. Harry would rather have taken 50 blast-ended Scroots for a walk than admit to Hagrid that he had overheard him talking to Madame Maxime, but Hagrid was still talking, apparently unaware that he had said anything odd.
"You know what, Harry," he said, looking up from the photograph of his father, his eyes very bright. "When I first met you, you reminded me of me a bit. Mum and Dad gone, and you was feeling like you wouldn't fit in at Hogwarts, remember? Not sure you were really up to it. And now look at you, Harry. School champion!"
He looked at Harry for a moment, and then said, very seriously,
"You know what I'd love, Harry? I'd love you to win. I really would. It'd show 'em all. You don't have to be pure blood to do it. You don't have to be ashamed of what you are. It'd show 'em Dumbledore's the one who's got it right. Letting anyone in as long as they can do magic. How are you doing with that egg, Harry?"
"Great," said Harry. "Really great."
Hagrid's miserable face broke into a wide, watery smile.
"That's my boy. You show 'em, Harry. You show 'em. Beat 'em all."
Lying to Hagrid wasn't quite like lying to anyone else. Harry went back to the castle later that afternoon with Ron and Hermione, unable to banish the image of the happy expression on Hagrid's whiskery face as he had imagined Harry winning the tournament. The incomprehensible egg weighed more heavily than ever on Harry's conscience that evening, and by the time he had got into bed, he had made up his mind. It was time to shelve his pride and see if Cedric's hint was worth anything.
Chapter 25. The Egg and the Eye. As Harry had no idea how long a bath he would need to work out the secret of the golden egg, he decided to do it at night, when he would be able to take as much time as he wanted. Reluctant though he was to accept more favours from Cedric, he also decided to use the prefect's bathroom. Far fewer people were allowed in there, so it was much less likely that he would be disturbed. Harry planned his excursion carefully. Because he had been caught out of bed and out of bounds by Filch the caretaker in the middle of the night once before, and had no desire to repeat the experience. The invisibility cloak would, of course, be essential, and as an added precaution, Harry thought he would take the Marauder's map, which, next to the cloak, was the most useful aid to rule-breaking Harry owned. The map showed the whole of Hogwarts, including its many shortcuts and secret passageways, and, most importantly of all, it revealed the people inside the castle as minuscule, labelled dots moving around the corridors, so that Harry would be forewarned if somebody was approaching the bathroom. On Thursday night, Harry sneaked up to bed, put on the cloak, crept back downstairs, and, just as he had done on the night when Hagrid had shown him the dragons, waited for the portrait hole to open. This time it was Ron who waited outside to give the fat lady the password, banana fritters. "Good luck," Ron muttered, climbing into the common room as Harry crept out past him. It was awkward moving under the cloak tonight, because Harry had the heavy egg under one arm and the map held in front of his nose with the other. However, the moonlit corridors were empty and silent, and by checking the map at strategic intervals, Harry was able to ensure that he wouldn't run into anyone he wanted to avoid. When he reached the statue of Boris the Bewildered, a lost-looking wizard with his gloves on the wrong hands, he located the right door, leant close to it, and muttered the password, "Pine Fresh," just as Cedric had told him. The door creaked open. Harry slipped inside, bolted the door behind him, and pulled off the invisibility cloak, looking around. His immediate reaction was that it would be worth becoming a prefect just to be able to use this bathroom. It was softly lit by a splendid candle-filled chandelier, and everything was made of white marble, including what looked like an empty rectangular swimming pool sunk into the middle of the floor. About 100 gold taps stood all around the pool's edges, each with a different coloured jewel set into its handle. There was also a diving board. Long white linen curtains hung at the windows, a large pile of fluffy white towels sat in a corner, and there was a single golden-framed painting on the wall. It featured a blonde mermaid who was fast asleep on a rock, her long hair fluttering over her face every time she snored. Harry put down his cloak, the egg, and the map, and moved forwards, looking around, his footsteps echoing off the walls. Magnificent though the bathroom was, and quite keen though he was to try out a few of those taps, now he was here, he couldn't quite suppress the feeling that Cedric might have been having him on. How on earth was this supposed to help solve the mystery of the egg? Nevertheless, he put one of the fluffy towels, the cloak, the map, and the egg at the side of the swimming pool-sized bath, then knelt down and turned on a few of the taps. He could tell at once that they carried different sorts of bubble bath mixed with the water, though it wasn't bubble bath as Harry had ever experienced it. One tap gushed pink and blue bubbles the size of footballs. Another poured ice-white foam so thick that Harry thought it would have supported his weight if he'd cared to test it. A third sent heavily perfumed purple clouds hovering over the surface of the water. Harry amused himself for a while, turning the taps on and off, particularly enjoying the effect of one whose jet bounced off the surface of the water in large arcs. Then, when the deep pool was full of hot water, foam and bubbles, which took a very short time considering its size, Harry turned off all the taps, pulled off his pyjamas, slippers and dressing gown, and slid into the water. It was so deep that his feet barely touched the bottom, and he actually did a couple of lengths before swimming back to the side and treading water, staring at the egg. Highly enjoyable, though it was, to swim in hot and foamy water with clouds of different coloured steam wafting all around him, no stroke of brilliance came to him, no sudden burst of understanding.
Harry stretched out his arms, lifted the egg in his wet hands, and opened it. The wailing, screeching sound filled the bathroom, echoing and reverberating off the marble walls, but it sounded just as incomprehensible as ever, if not more so with all the echoes. He snapped it shut again, worried that the sound would attract Filch, wondering whether that hadn't been Cedric's plan, and then, making him jump so badly that he dropped the egg, which clattered away across the bathroom floor, someone spoke.
"I'd try putting it in the water, if I were you."
Harry had swallowed a considerable amount of bubbles in shock. He stood up, spluttering, and saw the ghost of a very glum-looking girl sitting cross-legged on top of one of the taps. It was Moaning Myrtle, who was usually to be heard sobbing in the S-bend of a toilet three floors below.
"Myrtle!" Harry said in outrage. "I'm not wearing anything!"
The foam was so dense that this hardly mattered, but he had a nasty feeling that Myrtle had been spying on him from out of one of the taps ever since he had arrived.
"I closed my eyes when you got in," she said, blinking at him through her thick spectacles. "You haven't been to see me for ages."
"Yeah, well," said Harry, bending his knees slightly, just to make absolutely sure Myrtle couldn't see anything but his head.
"I'm not supposed to come into your bathroom, am I? It's a girl's one." "You didn't used to care," said Myrtle, miserably. "You used to be in there all the time."
This was true, though only because Harry, Ron, and Hermione had found Myrtle's out-of-order toilets a convenient place to brew polyjuice potion in secret, a forbidden potion which had turned Harry and Ron into living replicas of Crabbe and Goyle for an hour so that they could sneak into the Slytherin common room.
"I got told off for going in there," said Harry, which was half true. Percy had once caught him coming out of Myrtle's bathroom. "I thought I'd better not come back after that."
"Oh, I see," said Myrtle, picking at a spot on her chin in a morose sort of way.
"Well, anyway, I'd try the egg in the water. That's what Cedric Diggory did." "Have you been spying on him too?" said Harry indignantly. "What do you do, sneak up here in the evenings to watch the prefects take baths?"
"Sometimes," said Myrtle, rather slyly, "but I've never come out to speak to anyone before."
"I'm honoured," said Harry, darkly. "You keep your eyes shut."
He made sure Myrtle had her glasses well covered before hoisting himself out of the bath, wrapping the towel firmly around himself, and going to get the egg. Once he was back in the water, Myrtle peered through her fingers and said,
"Go on, then. Open it under the water."
Harry lowered the egg beneath the foamy surface and opened it. And this time it did not wail. A gurgling song was coming out of it, a song whose words he couldn't distinguish through the water.
"You need to put your head under, too," said Myrtle, who seemed to be thoroughly enjoying bossing him around. "Go on!"
Harry took a great breath and slid under the surface, and now, sitting on the marble bottom of the bubble-filled bath, he heard a chorus of eerie voices singing to him from the open egg in his hands.
"Come, seek us where our voices sound. We cannot sing above the ground. And while you're searching, ponder this. We've taken what you'll sorely miss. An hour long you'll have to look and to recover what we took. But past an hour, the prospect's black. Too late. It's gone. It won't come back."
Harry let himself float back upwards and broke the bubbly surface, shaking his hair out of his eyes.
"Hear it?" said Myrtle.
"Yeah. Come seek us where our voices sound. And if I need persuading... hang on. I need to listen again." He sank back beneath the water. It took three more underwater renditions of the egg's song before Harry had it memorized. Then he trod water for a while, thinking hard, while Myrtle sat and watched him.
"I've got to go and look for people who can't use their voices above the ground," he said slowly. "Who would that be?"
"Slow, aren't you?" He had never seen Moaning Myrtle so cheerful, apart from the day when Hermione's dose of polyjuice potion had given her the hairy face and tail of a cat. Harry stared around the bathroom, thinking. If the voices could only be heard underwater, then it made sense for them to belong to underwater creatures. He ran this theory past Myrtle, who smirked at him.
"Well, that's what Diggory thought," she said. "He lay there talking to himself for ages about it, ages and ages. Nearly all the bubbles had gone."
"Underwater," Harry said slowly.
"Myrtle, what lives in the lake, apart from the giant squid?"
"Oh, all sorts," she said. "I sometimes go down there. Sometimes don't have any choice if someone flushes my toilet when I'm not expecting it."
Trying not to think about moaning Myrtle zooming down a pipe to the lake with the contents of a toilet, Harry said,
"Well, does anything in there have human voices? Hang on."
Harry's eyes had fallen on the picture of the snoozing mermaid on the wall.
"Myrtle, there aren't mer-people in there, are there?" "Ooh, very good," she said, her thick glasses twinkling. "It took Diggory much longer than that, and that was with her awake, too."
Myrtle jerked her head towards the mermaid with an expression of great dislike on her glum face,
giggling and showing off and flashing her fins. "That's it, isn't it?" said Harry excitedly. "The second task's to go and find the mer-people in the lake and...
But he suddenly realised what he was saying, and he felt the excitement drain out of him, as though someone had just pulled a plug in his stomach. He wasn't a very good swimmer. He had never had much practice. Dudley had had lessons in their youth, but Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon, no doubt hoping that Harry would drown one day, hadn't bothered to give him any. A couple of lengths of this bath was all very well, but that lake was very large and very deep, and mer-people would surely live right at the bottom.
"Myrtle," Harry said slowly, "how am I supposed to breathe?"
At this, Myrtle's eyes filled with sudden tears again.
"Tactless," she muttered, groping in her robes for a handkerchief.
"What's tactless?" said Harry, bewildered.
"Talking about breathing in front of me," she said shrilly, and her voice echoed loudly around the bathroom. "When I can't, when I haven't, not for ages."
She buried her face in her handkerchief and sniffed loudly. Harry remembered how touchy Myrtle had always been about being dead, but none of the other ghosts he knew made such a fuss about it.
"Oh, sorry," he said impatiently. "I didn't mean, I just forgot." "Oh, yes, very easy to forget Myrtle's dead," said Myrtle, gulping, looking at him out of swollen eyes. "Nobody missed me, even when I was alive. Took them hours and hours to find my body. I know, I was sitting there waiting for them. Olive Hornby came into the bathroom. 'Are you in here again sulking, Myrtle?' she said, 'because Professor Dippet asked me to look for you.' And then she saw my body. Ooh, she didn't forget it until her dying day. I made sure of that. Followed her around and reminded her I did. I remember at her brother's wedding."
But Harry wasn't listening. He was thinking about the mer-people's song again. "We've taken what you'll sorely miss." That sounded as though they were going to steal something of his, something he had to get back. What were they going to take?
"And then, of course, she went to the Ministry of Magic to stop me stalking her, so I had to come back here and live in my toilet."
Good, said Harry, vaguely. "Well, I'm a lot further on than I was. Shut your eyes again, will you? I'm getting out." He retrieved the egg from the bottom of the bath, climbed out, dried himself, and pulled on his pyjamas and dressing gown again.
"Will you come and visit me in my bathroom again sometime?"
Moaning Myrtle asked mournfully, as Harry picked up the invisibility cloak.
"I'll try,"
Harry said, though privately thinking the only way he'd be visiting Myrtle's bathroom again was if every other toilet in the castle got blocked.
"See you, Myrtle. Thanks for your help."
"Bye-bye,"
she said gloomily, and as Harry put on the invisibility cloak, he saw her zoom back up the tap. Out in the dark corridor, Harry examined the Marauder's map to check that the coast was still clear. Yes, the dots belonging to Filch and Mrs. Norris were safely in their office. Nothing else seemed to be moving apart from Peeves, who was bouncing around the trophy room on the floor above. Harry had taken his first step back towards Gryffindor Tower when something else on the map caught his eye, something distinctly odd. Peeves was not the only thing that was moving. A single dot was flitting around a room in the bottom left-hand corner, Snape's office. But the dot wasn't labelled Severus Snape. It was Bartemius Crouch. Harry stared at the dot. Mr. Crouch was supposed to be too ill to go to work or to come to the Yule Ball. So what was he doing, sneaking into Hogwarts at 1 o'clock in the morning? Harry watched closely as the dot moved round and round the room, pausing here and there. Harry hesitated, thinking, and then his curiosity got the better of him. He turned and set off in the opposite direction towards the nearest staircase. He was going to see what Crouch was up to. Harry walked down the stairs as quietly as possible, though the faces in some of the portraits still turned curiously at the squeak of a floorboard, the rustle of his pyjamas. He crept along the corridor below, pushed aside a tapestry about halfway along, and proceeded down a narrower staircase, a shortcut which would take him down 2 floors. He kept glancing down at the map, wondering. It just didn't seem in character somehow for correct, law-abiding Mr. Crouch to be sneaking around somebody else's office this late at night. And then, halfway down the staircase, not thinking about what he was doing, not concentrating on anything but the peculiar behaviour of Mr. Crouch, Harry's leg suddenly sank right through the trick step Neville always forgot to jump. He gave an ungainly wobble, and the golden egg, still damp from the bath, slipped from under his arm. He lurched forwards to try and catch it, but too late. The egg fell down the long staircase with a bang as loud as a bass drum on every step. The invisibility cloak slipped. Harry snatched at it, and the marauder's map fluttered out of his hand and slid down 6 stairs, where, sunk in the step to above his knee, he couldn't reach it. The golden egg fell through the tapestry at the bottom of the staircase, burst open, and began wailing loudly in the corridor below. Harry pulled out his wand and struggled to touch the marauder's map, to wipe it blank, but it was too far away to reach. Pulling the cloak back over himself, Harry straightened up, listening hard, his eyes screwed up with fear, and almost immediately, "Peeves!" It was the unmistakable hunting cry of Filch the caretaker. Harry could hear his rapid, shuffling footsteps coming nearer and nearer, his wheezy voice raised in fury. "What's this racket? Wake up the whole castle, will you? I'll have you, Peeves, I'll have you! You'll... And what is this?" Filch's footsteps stopped. There was a clink of metal on metal, and the wailing stopped. Filch had picked up the egg and closed it. Harry stood very still, one leg still jammed tightly in the magical step, listening. Any moment now, Filch was going to pull aside the tapestry, expecting to see Peeves, and there would be no Peeves. But if he came up the stairs, he would spot the marauder's map, and, invisibility cloak or not, the map would show Harry Potter standing exactly where he was. "Egg," Filch said quietly at the foot of the stairs. "My sweet!" Mrs. Norris was obviously with him. "This is a tri-wizard clue. This belongs to a school champion!" Harry felt sick. His heart was hammering very fast. "Peeves!" Filch roared gleefully. "You've been stealing!" He ripped back the tapestry below, and Harry saw his horrible, pouchy face and bulging, pale eyes staring up the dark and, to Filch, deserted staircase. "Hiding, are you?" he said softly. "I'm coming to get you, Peeves. You've gone and stolen a tri-wizard clue, Peeves. Dumbledore'll have you out of here for this, you filthy, pilfering poltergeist!" Filch started to climb the stairs, his scrawny, dust-coloured cat at his heels. Mrs. Norris's lamp-like eyes, so very like her master's, were fixed directly upon Harry. He had had occasion before now to wonder whether the invisibility cloak worked on cats. Sick with apprehension, he watched Filch drawing nearer and nearer in his old flannel dressing gown. He tried desperately to pull his trapped leg free, but it merely sank a few more inches. Any second now, Filch was going to spot the map or walk right into him. "Filch, what's going on?" Filch stopped a few steps below Harry and turned. At the foot of the stairs stood the only person who could make Harry's situation worse, Snape. He was wearing a long grey nightshirt, and he looked livid.
"It's Peeves, Professor," Filch whispered malevolently. "He threw this egg down the stairs."
Snape climbed up the stairs quickly and stopped beside Filch. Harry gritted his teeth, convinced his loudly thumping heart would give him away at any second.
"Peeves?" said Snape softly, staring at the egg in Filch's hands. "But Peeves couldn't get into my office." "This egg was in your office, Professor?"
"Of course not," Snape snapped. "I heard banging and wailing."
"Yes, Professor, that was the egg. I was coming to investigate. Peeves threw it, Professor,
and when I passed my office, I saw that the torches were lit and a cupboard door was ajar. Somebody has been searching it."
"But Peeves couldn't—" "I know he couldn't, Filch," Snape snapped. "I seal my office with a spell none but a wizard could break."
Snape looked up the stairs, straight through Harry, and then down into the corridor below.
"I want you to come and help me search for the intruder, Filch."
Yes, Professor, but—"
Filch looked yearningly up the stairs, right through Harry, who could see that he was very reluctant to forego the chance of cornering Peeves.
"Go," Harry pleaded with him silently. "Go with Snape. Go."
Mrs. Norris was peering around Filch's legs. Harry had the distinct impression that she could smell him. Why had he filled that bath with so much perfumed foam?
"The thing is, Professor," said Filch plaintively, "the headmaster will have to listen to me this time. Peeves has been stealing from a student. It might be my chance to get him thrown out of the castle once and for all."
"Filch, I don't give a damn about that wretched poltergeist. It's my office that's—"
Clunk, clunk, clunk.
Snape stopped talking very abruptly. He and Filch both looked down at the foot of the stairs. Harry saw Mad-Eye Moody limp into sight through the narrow gap between their heads. Moody was wearing his old travelling cloak over his nightshirt and leaning on his staff as usual.
"Pyjama party, is it?"
he growled up the stairs.
"Professor Snape and I heard noises, Professor," said Filch at once. "Peeves the poltergeist, throwing things around as usual, and then Professor Snape discovered that someone had broken into his off—"
"Shut up!" Snape hissed to Filch.
Moody took a step closer to the foot of the stairs. Harry saw Moody's magical eye travel over Snape, and then, unmistakably, onto himself. Harry's heart gave a horrible jolt. Moody could see through invisibility cloaks. He alone could see the full strangeness of the scene. Snape in his nightshirt, Filch clutching the egg, and he, Harry, trapped in the stairs behind them. Moody's lopsided gash of a mouth opened in surprise. For a few seconds, he and Harry stared straight into each other's eyes. Then Moody closed his mouth and turned his blue eye upon Snape again.
"Did I hear that correctly, Snape?" he asked slowly. "Someone broke into your office?"
"It is unimportant," said Snape coldly.
"On the contrary," growled Moody, "it is very important. Who would want to break into your office?"
"A student, I dare say," said Snape.
Harry could see a vein flickering horribly on Snape's greasy temple.
"It has happened before. Potion ingredients have gone missing from my private store cupboard. Students attempting illicit mixtures, no doubt."
"Reckon they were after potion ingredients, eh?" said Moody. "Not hiding anything else in your office, are you?"
Harry saw the edge of Snape's sallow face turn a nasty brick colour, the vein in his temple pulsing more rapidly.
"You know I'm hiding nothing, Moody," he said in a soft and dangerous voice, "as you've searched my office pretty thoroughly yourself."
Moody's face twisted into a smile.
"Aura's privilege, Snape. Dumbledore told me to keep an eye—"
"Dumbledore happens to trust me," said Snape through clenched teeth. "I refuse to believe that he gave you orders to search my office."
"Course Dumbledore trusts you," growled Moody. "He's a trusting man, isn't he? Believes in second chances. But me?
I say there are spots that don't come off, Snape. Spots that never come off. Do you know what I mean?
Snape suddenly did something very strange. He seized his left forearm convulsively with his right hand, as though something on it had hurt him. Moody laughed.
Get back to bed, Snape. You don't have the authority to send me anywhere, Snape hissed, letting go of his arm as though angry with himself. I have as much right to prowl this school after dark as you do.
Prowl away, said Moody, but his voice was full of menace.
I look forward to meeting you in a dark corridor sometime. You've dropped something, by the way.
With a stab of horror, Harry saw Moody point at the Marauder's map, still lying on the staircase, 6 steps below him. As Snape and Filch both turned to look at it, Harry threw caution to the winds. He raised his arms under the cloak and waved furiously at Moody to attract his attention, mouthing, "It's mine! Mine!" Snape had reached out for it, a horrible expression of dawning comprehension on his face.
Axio parchment!
The map flew up into the air, slipped through Snape's outstretched fingers, and soared down the stairs into Moody's hand.
My mistake, Moody said calmly. It's mine. Must have dropped it earlier.
But Snape's black eyes were darting from the egg in Filch's arms to the map in Moody's hand, and Harry could tell he was putting 2 and 2 together, as only Snape could. Potter, he said quietly.
What's that?
Said Moody calmly, folding up the map and pocketing it.
Potter!
Snape snarled, and he actually turned his head and stared right at the place where Harry was, as though he could suddenly see him.
That egg is Potter's egg. That piece of parchment belongs to Potter. I've seen it before. I recognize it. Potter is here. Potter, in his invisibility cloak.
Snape stretched out his hands like a blind man and began to move up the stairs. Harry could have sworn his overlarge nostrils were dilating, trying to sniff Harry out. Trapped, Harry leant backwards, trying to avoid Snape's fingertips, but any moment now...
"There's nothing there, Snape!"
barked Moody. "But I'll be happy to tell the headmaster how quickly your mind jumped to Harry Potter."
"Meaning what?"
snarled Snape, turning again to look at Moody, his hands still outstretched inches from Harry's chest.
"Meaning that Dumbledore's very interested to know who's got it in for that boy," said Moody, limping nearer still to the foot of the stairs. "And so am I, Snape, very interested."
The torchlight flickered across his mangled face, so that the scars and the chunk missing from his nose looked deeper and darker than ever. Snape was looking down at Moody, and Harry couldn't see the expression on his face. For a moment, nobody moved or said anything. Then Snape slowly lowered his hands.
"I've merely thought,"
said Snape, in a voice of forced calm, "that if Potter was wandering around after hours again, it's an unfortunate habit of his, he should be stopped for his own safety."
"Ah, I see," said Moody, softly. "Got Potter's best interest at heart, have you?"
There was a pause. Snape and Moody were still staring at each other. Mrs. Norris gave a loud meow, still peering around Filch's legs, looking for the source of Harry's bubble-bath smell.
"I think I will go back to bed," Snape said, curtly. "Best idea you've had all night," said Moody. "Now, Filch, if you'll just give me that egg—"
"No!" said Filch, clutching the egg as though it was his first-born son. "Professor Moody, this is evidence of Peeves's treachery!"
"It's the property of the champion he stole it from," said Moody. "Hand it over, now!"
Snape swept downstairs and passed Moody without another word. Filch made a chirruping noise to Mrs. Norris, who stared blankly at Harry for a few more seconds before turning and following her master. Still breathing very fast, Harry heard Snape walking away down the corridor. Filch handed Moody the egg and disappeared from view too, muttering to Mrs. Norris,
"Never mind, my sweet. We'll see Dumbledore in the morning. Tell him what Peeves was up to."
A door slammed. Harry was left staring down at Moody, who placed his staff on the bottommost stair and started to climb laboriously towards him, a dull clunk on every other step.
"Close shave, Potter," he muttered.
"Yeah, thanks," said Harry, weakly.
"What is this thing?"
said Moody, drawing the Marauder's map out of his pocket and unfolding it. "Map of Hogwarts," said Harry, hoping Moody was going to pull him out of the staircase soon. His leg was really hurting him.
"Merlin's beard,"
Moody whispered, staring at the map, his magical eye going haywire.
This is some map, Potter."
"Yeah, it's quite useful," Harry said. His eyes were starting to water from the pain. "Professor Moody, do you think you could help me?"
"What? Oh, yes, yes, of course."
Moody took hold of Harry's arms and pulled. Harry's leg came free of the trick step, and he climbed onto the one above it. Moody was still gazing at the map.
"Potter," he said slowly, "you didn't happen by any chance to see who broke into Snape's office, did you? On this map, I mean."
"Yeah, I did," Harry admitted. "It was Mr. Crouch." Moody's magical eye whizzed over the entire surface of the map. He looked suddenly alarmed.
"Crouch," he said. You're sure, Potter?"
"Positive," said Harry.
"Well, he's not here any more," said Moody,
his eyes still whizzing over the map.
"Crouch, that's very, very interesting."
He said nothing for almost a minute, still staring at the map. Harry could tell that this news meant something to Moody and very much wanted to know what it was. He wondered whether he dared ask. Moody scared him slightly. Yet Moody had just helped him avoid an awful lot of trouble. "Professor Moody, why do you reckon Mr. Crouch wanted to look around Snape's office?" Moody's magical eye left the map and fixed, quivering, upon Harry. It was a penetrating glare, and Harry had the impression that Moody was sizing him up, wondering whether to answer or not, or how much to tell him.
"Put it this way, Potter," Moody muttered finally. "They say old Mad-Eye's obsessed with catching dark wizards, but Mad-Eye's nothing, nothing, compared to Barty Crouch."
He continued to stare at the map. Harry was burning to know more. "Professor Moody," he said again, "do you think, could this have anything to do with, maybe Mr. Crouch thinks there's something going on?"
"Like what?" said Moody sharply.
Harry wondered how much he dare say. He didn't want Moody to guess that he had a source of information outside Hogwarts. That might lead to tricky questions about Sirius. "Oh, I don't know," Harry muttered. "Odd stuff's been happening lately, hasn't it? It's been in the Daily Prophet. The Dark Mark at the World Cup and the Death Eaters and everything." Both of Moody's mismatched eyes widened.
"You're a sharp boy, Potter,"
he said. His magical eye roved back to the Marauder's map.
"Crouch could be thinking along those lines," he said, slowly. "Very possible. There have been some funny rumours flying around lately, helped along by Rita Skeeter, of course. It's making a lot of people nervous, I reckon."
A grim smile twisted his lopsided mouth.
"Oh, if there's one thing I hate,"
he muttered, more to himself than Harry, and his magical eye was fixed on the bottom left-hand corner of the map,
"it's a Death Eater who walked free."
Harry stared at him. Could Moody possibly mean what Harry thought he meant?
"And now I want to ask you a question, Potter," said Moody, in a more business-like tone.
Harry's heart sank. He had thought this was coming. Moody was going to ask where he had got this map, which was a very dubious magical object, and the story of how it had fallen into his hands incriminated not only him, but his own father, Fred and George Weasley, and Professor Lupin, their last defence against the dark arts teacher. Moody waved the map in front of Harry, who braced himself.
"Can I borrow this?"
"Oh," said Harry. He was very fond of his map. But on the other hand, he was extremely relieved that Moody wasn't asking where he'd got it, and there was no doubt that he owed Moody a favour. "Yeah, okay."
"Good boy,"
growled Moody.
"I can make good use of this. This might be exactly what I've been looking for. Right, bed, Potter. Come on now."
They climbed to the top of the stairs together, Moody still examining the map as though it was a treasure, the like of which he had never seen before. They walked in silence to the door of Moody's office, where he stopped and looked up at Harry.
"You ever thought of a career as an aura, Potter?"
"No," said Harry, taken aback.
"You want to consider it," said Moody, nodding and looking at Harry thoughtfully. "Yes, indeed. And, incidentally, I'm guessing you weren't just taking that egg for a walk tonight."
No, said Harry, grinning. "I've been working out the clue." Moody winked at him, his magical eye going haywire again.
"Nothing like a night-time stroll to give you ideas, Potter. See you in the morning."
He went back into his office, staring down at the Marauder's map again, and closed the door behind him. Harry walked slowly back to Gryffindor Tower, lost in thought about Snape and Crouch and what it all meant. Why was Crouch pretending to be ill if he could manage to get to Hogwarts when he wanted to? What did he think Snape was concealing in his office? And Moody thought he, Harry, ought to be an aura. Interesting idea. But as Harry got quietly into his four-poster 10 minutes later, the egg and the cloak now safely back in his trunk, he somehow thought he'd like to check how scarred the rest of them were before he chose it as a career.
Chapter 26. The Second Task.
"You said you'd already worked out that egg clue," said Hermione indignantly.
"Keep your voice down," said Harry crossly. "I just need to sort of fine-tune it, all right?" He, Ron and Hermione were sitting at the very back of the charms class with a table to themselves. They were supposed to be practicing the opposite of the summoning charm today, the banishing charm. Owing to the potential for nasty accidents when objects kept flying across the room, Professor Flitwick had given each student a stack of cushions on which to practice, the theory being that these wouldn't hurt anyone if they went off target. It was a good theory, but it wasn't working very well. Neville's aim was so poor that he kept accidentally sending much heavier things flying across the room. Professor Flitwick, for instance.
"Just forget the egg for a minute, all right?" Harry hissed, as Professor Flitwick went whizzing resignedly past them, landing on top of a large cabinet. "I'm trying to tell you about Snape and Moody."
This class was ideal cover for a private conversation, as everyone was having far too much fun to pay them any attention. Harry had been recounting his adventures of the previous night in whispered instalments for the last half an hour.
"Snape said Moody searched his office as well,"
Ron whispered, his eyes alight with interest, as he banished a cushion with a sweep of his wand. It soared into the air and knocked Parvati's hat off.
"What, do you reckon Moody's here to keep an eye on Snape as well as Karkaroff?"
"Well, I don't know if that's what Dumbledore asked him to do, but he's definitely doing it," said Harry, waving his wand without paying much attention, so that his cushion did an odd sort of belly flop off the desk.
"Moody said Dumbledore only let Snape stay here because he's giving him a second chance or something."
"What?" said Ron, his eyes widening, his next cushion spinning high into the air, ricocheting off the chandelier and dropping heavily onto Flitwick's desk.
"Harry, maybe Moody thinks Snape put your name in the Goblet of Fire." "Oh, Ron," said Hermione, shaking her head sceptically. "We thought Snape was trying to kill Harry before, and it turned out he was saving Harry's life, remember?"
She banished a cushion, and it flew across the room and landed in the box they were all supposed to be aiming at. Harry looked at Hermione, thinking.
It was true that Snape had saved his life once, but the odd thing was, Snape definitely loathed him, just as he'd loathed Harry's father when they had been at school together. Snape loved taking points from Harry, and had certainly never missed an opportunity to give him punishments, or even to suggest that he should be suspended from the school. "I don't care what Moody says," Hermione went on. "Dumbledore's not stupid. He was right to trust Hagrid and Professor Lupin, even though loads of people wouldn't have given them jobs. So why shouldn't he be right about Snape, even if Snape is a bit evil?" said Ron promptly. "Come on, Hermione, why are all these dark wizard catchers searching his office, then?" "Why has Mr. Crouch been pretending to be ill?" said Hermione, ignoring Ron. "It's a bit funny, isn't it, that he can't manage to come to the Yule Ball, but he can get up here in the middle of the night when he wants to."
"You just don't like Crouch because of that elf, Winky," said Ron, sending a cushion soaring into the window.
"You just want to think Snape's up to something," said Hermione, sending her cushion zooming neatly into the box.
"I just want to know what Snape did with his first chance, if he's on his second one," said Harry grimly, and his cushion, to his very great surprise, flew straight across the room and landed neatly on top of Hermione's. Obedient to Sirius' wish of hearing about anything odd at Hogwarts, Harry sent him a letter by Brown Owl that night, explaining all about Mr. Crouch breaking into Snape's office and Moody and Snape's conversation. Then Harry turned his attention in earnest to the most urgent problem facing him: how to survive underwater for an hour on the 24th of February. Ron quite liked the idea of using the summoning charm again. Harry had explained about aqualungs, and Ron couldn't see why Harry shouldn't summon one from the nearest Muggle town. Hermione squashed this plan by pointing out that in the unlikely event that Harry managed to learn how to operate an aqualung within the set limit of an hour, he was sure to be disqualified for breaking the International Code of Wizarding Secrecy. It was too much to hope that no Muggles would spot an aqualung zooming across the countryside to Hogwarts. "Of course, the ideal solution would be for you to transfigure yourself into a submarine or something," she said. "If only we'd done human transfiguration already. But I don't think we start that until sixth year, and it can go badly wrong if you don't know what you're doing."
"Yeah, I don't fancy walking around with a periscope sticking out of my head," said Harry. "I suppose I could always attack someone in front of Moody. He might do it for me."
"I don't think he'd let you choose what you wanted to be turned into, though," said Hermione seriously. "No, I think your best chance is some sort of charm." So Harry, thinking that he would soon have had enough of the library to last him a lifetime, buried himself once more among the dusty volumes, looking for any spell that might enable a human to survive without oxygen. However, though he, Ron and Hermione searched through their lunchtimes, evenings and whole weekends, though Harry asked Professor McGonagall for a note of permission to use the restricted section, and even asked the irritable, vulture-like librarian, Madame Pince, for help, they found nothing whatsoever that would enable Harry to spend an hour underwater and live to tell the tale. Familiar flutterings of panic were starting to disturb Harry now, and he was finding it difficult to concentrate in lessons again. The lake, which Harry had always taken for granted as just another feature of the grounds, drew his eyes whenever he was near a classroom window, a great iron-grey mass of chilly water whose dark and icy depths were starting to seem as distant as the moon. Just as it had done before he had faced the Horntail, time was slipping away as though somebody had bewitched the clocks to go extra fast. There was a week to go before February the 24th. There was still time. There were 5 days to go. He was bound to find something soon. 3 days to go. Please let me find something, please. With 2 days left, Harry started to go off food again. The only good thing about breakfast on Monday was the return of the brown owl he had sent to Sirius. He pulled off the parchment, unrolled it, and saw the shortest letter Sirius had ever written to him. "Send date of next Hogsmeade weekend by return owl." Harry turned the parchment over and looked at the back, hoping to see something else, but it was blank. "Weekend after next," whispered Hermione, who had read the note over Harry's shoulder. "Here, take my quill and send this owl back straight away." Harry scribbled the dates down on the back of Sirius' letter, tied it back onto the brown owl's leg, and watched it take flight again. What had he expected? Advice on how to survive underwater? He had been so intent on telling Sirius all about Snape and Moody, he had completely forgotten to mention the egg's clue. "What's he want to know about the next Hogsmeade weekend for?" said Ron. "Dunno," said Harry dully. The momentary happiness that had flared inside him at the sight of the owl had died. "Come on, care of magical creatures." Whether Hagrid was trying to make up for the blast-ended Scroots, or because there were now only 2 Scroots left, or because he was trying to prove he could do anything that Professor Grubbly Plank could, Harry didn't know, but he had been continuing her lessons on unicorns ever since he'd returned to work.
It turned out that Hagrid knew quite as much about unicorns as he did about monsters, though it was clear that he found their lack of poisonous fangs disappointing. Today he had managed to capture 2 unicorn foals. Unlike full-grown unicorns, they were pure gold. Parvati and Lavender went into transports of delight at the sight of them, and even Pansy Parkinson had to work hard to conceal how much she liked them.
"Easier to spot than the adults," Hagrid told the class. "They turn silver when they're about 2 years old, and they grow horns at around 4. Don't go pure white till they're full-grown, round about 7. They're a bit more trusting when they're babies. Don't mind boys so much. Come on, move in a bit. You can pat 'em if you want. Give 'em a few of these sugar lumps." "You okay, Harry?"
Hagrid muttered, moving aside slightly, while most of the others swarmed around the baby unicorns.
"Yeah," said Harry.
"Just nervous, eh?"
said Hagrid. "Bit," said Harry.
"Harry,"
said Hagrid, clapping a massive hand on his shoulder so that Harry's knees buckled under its weight.
"I'd have been worried before I saw you take on that horntail, but I know now you can do anything you set your mind to. I'm not worried at all. You're going to be fine. Got your clue worked out, haven't you?"
Harry nodded, but even as he did so, an insane urge to confess that he didn't have any idea how to survive at the bottom of the lake for an hour came over him. He looked up at Hagrid. Perhaps he had to go into the lake sometimes to deal with the creatures in it. He looked after everything else in the grounds after all.
"You're gonna win,"
Hagrid growled, patting Harry's shoulder again, so that Harry actually felt himself sink a couple of inches into the muddy ground.
"I know it. I can feel it. You're gonna win, Harry."
Harry just couldn't bring himself to wipe the happy, confident smile off Hagrid's face. Pretending he was interested in the young unicorns, he forced a smile in return and moved forwards to pat them with the others. By the evening before the second task, Harry felt as though he was trapped in a nightmare. He was fully aware that even if, by some miracle, he managed to find a suitable spell, he'd have a real job mastering it overnight. How could he have let this happen? Why hadn't he got to work on the egg's clue sooner? Why had he ever let his mind wander in class? What if a teacher had once mentioned how to breathe underwater? He, Ron, and Hermione sat in the library as the sun set outside, tearing feverishly through page after page of spells, hidden from each other by the massive piles of books on the desk in front of each of them. Harry's heart gave a huge leap every time he saw the word water on a page, but more often than not it was merely take 2 pints of water, 1/2 pound of shredded mandrake leaves, and a newt. "I don't reckon it can be done," said Ron's voice flatly from the other side of the table. "There's nothing, nothing. Closest was that thing to dry up puddles and ponds, that drought charm, but that was nowhere near powerful enough to drain a lake." "There must be something," Hermione muttered, moving a candle closer to her. Her eyes were so tired she was poring over the tiny print of old and forgotten bewitchments and charms, with her nose about an inch from the page. "They'd never have set a task that was undoable."
"They have," said Ron.
"Harry, just go down to the lake tomorrow, right? Stick your head in, yell at the merpeople to give back whatever they've nicked, and see if they chuck it out. Best you can do, mate."
"There's a way of doing it," Hermione said crossly. "There just has to be."
She seemed to be taking the library's lack of useful information on the subject as a personal insult. It had never failed her before. "I know what I should have done," said Harry, resting, face down, on saucy tricks for tricky sorts. "I should have learnt to be an animagus, like Sirius."
"Yeah, you could have turned into a goldfish any time you wanted," said Ron.
"Or a frog,"
yawned Harry. He was exhausted.
"It takes years to become an animagus, and then you have to register yourself and everything,"
said Hermione vaguely, now squinting down the index of weird wizarding dilemmas and their solutions.
"Professor McGonagall told us, remember, you've got to register yourself with the Improper Use of Magic Office, what animal you become, and your markings, so you can't abuse it."
"Hermione, I was joking," said Harry wearily. "I know I haven't got a chance of turning into a frog by tomorrow morning."
"Oh, this is no use," Hermione said, snapping weird wizarding dilemmas shut. Who on earth wants to make their nose hair grow into ringlets?"
"I wouldn't mind," said Fred Weasley's voice. "Be a talking point, wouldn't it?"
Harry, Ron and Hermione looked up. Fred and George had just emerged from behind some bookshelves. "What are you two doing here?" Ron asked.
"Looking for you," said George. "McGonagall wants you, Ron. And you, Hermione."
"Why?" said Hermione, looking surprised.
"Dunno. She was looking a bit grim, though," said Fred.
"We're supposed to take you down to her office," said George. Ron and Hermione stared at Harry, who felt his stomach drop. Was Professor McGonagall about to tell Ron and Hermione off? Perhaps she had noticed how much they were helping him, when he ought to be working out how to do the task alone. "We'll meet you back in the common room," Hermione told Harry, as she got up to go with Ron. Both of them looked very anxious. "Bring as many of these books as you can, okay?"
"Right," said Harry, uneasily.
By 8 o'clock, Madame Pince had extinguished all the lamps and came to chivy Harry out of the library. Staggering under the weight of as many books as he could carry, Harry returned to the Gryffindor common room, pulled a table into a corner, and continued to search. There was nothing in Madcap Magic for Wacky Warlocks, nothing in A Guide to Medieval Sorcery, not one mention of underwater exploits in An Anthology of 18th-Century Charms, or in Dreadful Denizens of the Deep, or Powers You Never Knew You Had and What to Do with Them Now You've Wised Up. Crookshanks crawled into Harry's lap and curled up, purring deeply. The common room emptied slowly around Harry. People kept wishing him luck for the next morning in cheery, confident voices like Hagrid's, all of them apparently convinced that he was about to pull off another stunning performance like the one he had managed in the first task. Harry couldn't answer them. He just nodded, feeling as though there was a golf ball stuck in his throat. By 10 to midnight, he was alone in the room with Crookshanks. He had searched all the remaining books, and Ron and Hermione had not come back. "It's over," he told himself. "You can't do it. You'll just have to go down to the lake in the morning and tell the judges." He imagined himself explaining that he couldn't do the task. He pictured Bagman's look of round-eyed surprise, Karkaroff's satisfied yellow-toothed smile. He could almost hear Fleur Delacour saying, "I knew it. He is too young. He is only a little boy." He saw Malfoy flashing his Potter Stinks badge at the front of the crowd, saw Hagrid's crestfallen, disbelieving face. Forgetting that Crookshanks was on his lap, Harry stood up very suddenly. Crookshanks hissed angrily as he landed on the floor, gave Harry a disgusted look, and stalked away with his bottle-brush tail in the air. But Harry was already hurrying up the spiral staircase to his dormitory. He would grab the invisibility cloak and go back to the library. He'd stay there all night if he had to. "Lumos," Harry whispered 15 minutes later as he opened the library door. Wand tip alight, he crept along the bookshelves, pulling down more books, books of hexes and charms, books on merpeople and water monsters, books on famous witches and wizards, on magical inventions, on anything at all that might include one passing reference to underwater survival. He carried them over to a table, then set to work, searching them by the narrow beam of his wand, occasionally checking his watch. 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning. The only way he could keep going was to tell himself over and over again, "Next book, in the next one, the next one." The mermaid in the painting in the prefect's bathroom was laughing. Harry was bobbing like a cork in bubbly water next to her rock while she held his firebolt over his head.
"Come and get it," she giggled maliciously. "Come on, jump."
"I can't," Harry panted, snatching at the firebolt and struggling not to sink.
"Give it to me."
But she just poked him painfully in the side with the end of the broom, laughing at him.
"That hurts. Get off. Ouch. Harry Potter must wake up, sir. Stop poking me. Dobby must poke Harry Potter, sir. He must wake up."
Harry opened his eyes. He was still in the library. The invisibility cloak had slipped off his head as he had slept. and the side of his face was stuck to the pages of Where There's a Wand, There's a Way. He sat up, straightening his glasses, blinking in the bright daylight.
"Harry Potter needs to hurry!" squeaked Dobby. "The second task starts in 10 minutes, and Harry Potter—"
10 minutes? Harry croaked.
Ten minutes?!
He looked down at his watch. Dobby was right. It was 9:20. A large, dead weight seemed to fall through Harry's chest into his stomach.
"Hurry, Harry Potter!" squeaked Dobby, plucking at Harry's sleeve. "You is supposed to be down by the lake with the other champions, sir!"
"It's too late, Dobby," Harry said hopelessly. "I'm not doing the task. I don't know how."
"Harry Potter will do the task!" squeaked the elf. "Dobby knew Harry had not found the right book, so Dobby did it for him."
"What?" said Harry. "But you don't know what the second task is."
"Dobby knows, sir. Harry Potter has to go into the lake and find his Wheezy."
"Find my what?"
"And take his Wheezy back from the merpeople."
"What's a Wheezy?"
"Your Wheezy, sir. Your Wheezy. Wheezy, who is giving Dobby his jumper."
Dobby plucked at the shrunken maroon sweater he was now wearing over his shorts.
"What?" Harry gasped. "They've got Ron. The thing Harry Potter will miss most, sir," squeaked Dobby. "And past an hour—"
"The prospect's black," Harry recited, staring, horror-struck, at the elf. "Too late, it's gone, it won't come back. Dobby, what have I got to do?"
"You has to eat this, sir,"
squeaked the elf, and he put his hand in the pocket of his shorts and drew out a ball of what looked like slimy, greyish-green rat tails.
"Right before you go into the lake, sir. Gillyweed."
"What's it do?" said Harry, staring at the gillyweed.
"It will make Harry Potter breathe under water, sir."
"Dobby," said Harry frantically, "listen, are you sure about this?" He couldn't quite forget that the last time Dobby had tried to help him, he had ended up with no bones in his right arm.
"Dobby is quite sure, sir," said the elf earnestly. "Dobby hears things, sir. He is a house elf. He goes all over the castle as he lights the fires and mops the floors. Dobby heard Professor McGonagall and Professor Moody in the staff room talking about the next task. Dobby cannot let Harry Potter lose his Wheezy."
Harry's doubts vanished. Jumping to his feet, he pulled off the invisibility cloak, stuffed it into his bag, grabbed the gillyweed and put it in his pocket, then tore out of the library with Dobby at his heels.
"Dobby is supposed to be in the kitchen, sir,"
Dobby squealed as they burst into the corridor.
"Dobby will be missed. Good luck, Harry Potter, sir. Good luck."
"See you later, Dobby," Harry shouted, and he sprinted along the corridor and down the stairs, three at a time.